Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Well, Harm, it certainly doesn't look any better. Four games into this road trip, which we talked about heading into our last podcast, they played one good period in Ottawa and three consecutive losses since. This team is actually in a worse position than they were through the same number of games a year ago from a points percentage standpoint. As bad as that was, they're 1 point worse right now. We're talking about coaching changes. We're talking about players simply not trying. I mean, wow. Like, this is, everyone says that when things are going bad, when there's chaos and calamity, that's the best time to cover a team. I don't think so.
Yeah, it's every time I feel like I record one of these episodes, ever since I've joined the VanCast, it feels like we just keep hitting new lows and I'm waiting for us to kind of hit rock bottom, for the team to hit rock bottom and then start trending back upward. But this has just been an utter collapse, and it just gets more and more depressing the deeper it gets. But we're entering the territory now where losses are a good thing. I'd never thought we'd get here by mid-November, but at this point I can't help but already think, looking ahead at the schedule and the standings and where the team's at, we're already at a point where it's probably in this team's best interest to tank and continue losing rather than actually get this thing back on track.
Yeah, well, it's hard to argue with that. And I know you did a deep dive in The Athletic talking about the Canucks' best path to tanking. And we'll get into that as the show goes. But first, let's talk about Bruce Boudreau and kind of work our way backward from there, because there certainly are, I don't want to say reports of his firing, but I think an understanding that everybody knows this is now a case of when and not if, right? And we're hearing reports, Friedman and others have talked about possibly, I think Kevin Weeks has talked about Rick Tocchet as a person of interest. You know, like I know that there was there's been thoughts on the timing and why this has taken so long, because clearly he's dead man walking, right? And, you know, Bruce doesn't know of anything being imminent. You know, I can tell you that right now. But, you know, he's not dumb, right? I mean, certainly you've got to look around and see what's going on. His contract runs out at the end of the year. They haven't made a decision yet. Or maybe they have, and they're just trying to figure out timing. And there's so many variables around it. Do you want the team to tank? Do you want to wait as long as possible so you're paying a new guy as little as possible for the current year? Do you want to just let the contract run out and hopefully it's the worst case scenario from a points percentage standpoint? Or do you want to bring a guy in at some point so he can teach this group or whoever remains of this group in the next offseason what his systems are like and get used to him heading into next year so there isn't a level of newness? They can kind of get through all of that. There's so many theories on what the right way for management and ownership to handle this is. Does ownership, you know, want to be paying multiple guys? Do they want to hire internally so they're not having to pay more? Like, there's so many layers to this, and you can come up with a reasonable hypothesis to all of it, but are we just counting down the days now?
I do think we are. And it was interesting because on the first road trip, we all remember the Canucks sort of setting an NHL record in terms of multi-goal leads leading to losses to begin a season. And ahead of the Minnesota game, I think it was after the Columbus one, Boudreau and Rutherford, from my understanding, did sort of meet and they had a discussion about a lot of things that Rutherford has spoken about publicly in terms of the accountability for certain individual players, and not just referring to players on the fringes, but players at the top end of the roster as well. Also structure-wise, I think that's where Rutherford in that meeting and in that conversation, it was a casual one. It wasn't this, it wasn't a sort of big thing on the agenda, but Rutherford sort of brought up those same concerns about structure and preparation. And I do wonder if at that point, Boudreau was already starting to feel nervous about his standing in the organization and about his long-term future. One thing I will say at this point is whatever the franchise decides to do, whether it's management and ownership making this decision together, don't try and fix things just to chase being 9th or 10th in the West. Just stop. I think my perspective on this is find your head coach in the offseason. Nobody wants a useless new coach bump. Now, I agree that this situation is getting close to being untenable. And if it continues this way, even just out of mercy for Bruce, it's probably best to pull the plug at some point. But if you're going to do that, I think you just got to promote internally with Mike Yeo or Jeremy Colleton, because going back to last season, the Boudreau bump is the worst thing that could have possibly happened to this franchise. Bruce did such a good job that it made this organization believe and continue searching for quick fixes. One thing about this organization that we know based off of the past number of years is that they will always take the easy way out. They will always take the path to least resistance. They will always look for that shortcut. For me, this situation needs to get so hopeless that they can't think otherwise.
Yeah, but now, how do you make it hopeless? Because the challenge is that if you keep Bruce, Bruce is going to keep trying to win games, right?
No, well, that's the thing. That's why if you're going to let him go at some point, which I fully agree, at some point you got to have mercy for him. I really feel for the situation he's in. You do that, you promote Yeo or Colleton. Yeo and Colleton, they've went in their head coaching stints have not typically done a good job. Colleton's record with the Blackhawks was horrific. And we're already seeing Chicago now with Luke Richardson play so much more structured. And you talk to any Chicago fans, they're lamenting how poorly the team played in front of Colleton. Mike Yeo, of course, was the head coach for the St. Louis Blues right before they fired him and then went on to win the Stanley Cup. So these guys can be your tank commanders. One of those guys. I don't think you're worried about if you let Bruce go and you promote a Yeo or a Colleton that all of a sudden the team's going to have a massive bump. I mean, maybe they do, but I certainly wouldn't bet on it, as opposed to if they go out and try and chase a Barry Trotz or a Rick Tocchet, as some insiders have speculated. That would be my worry, is if you bring in an actual legit high-end head coach mid-season, I just don't want this team to go through the same second half bump that they had last season. I just can't do the whole Groundhog Day thing again.
I know, but could any coach do that, right? Like, just a change in and of itself, certainly you know, Travis was a bit more of a taskmaster and Bruce kind of was cuddly and warm and fuzzy and took some of the pressure off the guys. But sometimes change, regardless, gets people's attention in a way that it didn't before. Like, you wonder, even if it is Colin, even if it is Yo, that it won't lead to some level of bump.
I don't think so. I don't think meaningful in any way, because we already went through the house cleaning process last season. Management changed, coaching changed. If anything, the whole organization had a chance to kind of reset and leave all of the baggage in the past. And yet, at the end of the day, you still have the same core group of players. Clearly, it's the players at this point that have this baggage on them. And you can change what's around them. At the end of the day, right now, watching them play so far this season, they look like Coach Killers the last couple of seasons.
Oh my God. Like, it's just horrific. Like, the one guy you can say consistently, there's two guys that give incredible effort on a daily basis, Bo Horvat and Elias Pettersson. And the rest of it, like, wow, it really makes you reevaluate the core of this team. You just wonder where they're at. You wonder what their level of mental toughness, commitment, any of it is. Like, I don't know that they're trying to get Bruce fired. I don't think so, given, you know, just how little time he's been there, right? And how easy he makes it for them. But collectively, this mix is just a disaster. And if you're Bruce, you're right. Like, I almost feel that it'd be great for him to just kind of have this relief from him. You're going to get paid the rest of the season anyway. And I know there's a lot of people who believe that this is Bruce's last chance to be an NHL head coach, so he's going to fight for every day of it. But if you do decide to move on and bring in Colleton or Yo, you know, elevate them into that role, like, they've got to be given strict instructions. Like, we're playing the young guys. You know, these are the things that are the priorities for us now. It's not trying to scramble into 9th or 10th, right? You know, you wonder how those guys react to that, right? Because ultimately, they're coaching for their resume and their next opportunity.
For sure. And you do reference the young players there. And I think that's the biggest concern that I've had since Boudreaux has taken over. He's had a lot of success, especially in the second half of the season, turning the team around in terms of wins and losses. But you look at now in the big picture, wins and losses today don't matter. What matters is developing the young players. And that's where I look at a player like Nils Höglander. He's been a shadow of a player that he was under Travis Green. Remember, he came in and he blew the doors down. He was immediately winning a top six job next to Bo Horvat. He was just so noticeable every night. And it feels like under Boudreaux, he's lost a lot of his offensive confidence. He's been shuffled up and down the lineup. He clearly doesn't have Bruce's confidence at all. And for a young player, that does affect your psyche. He's been in and out of the lineup. I don't think that's good for his development. And the thing that bothers me the most about the way Höglander has been kind of handled this season is that, and we kind of referenced it during the last episode, is he'll have games where he plays well and he's doing a lot of the little things that you'd want to see him make in terms of being more energetic and effective on the forecheck, backchecking a lot more effectively, little plays along the wall in the defensive zone to lead clean exits. Like, his details have started to improve. The problem is, even sometimes when he plays a decent game, he still ends up in the press box. That was the case, I believe it was against Minnesota, where Höglander had a great game against Columbus, and Boudreaux referenced as much. But against the Wild, Boudreaux's rationale for scratching Höglander was essentially the Wild are a big, heavy team and Höglander small. Like, that's essentially what it came down to. And as a young player, that must be pretty demotivating when you play such an effective game and you're working on a lot of these habits that Boudreaux wants you to fix, and you still end up in the press box, so you're still not playing a lot. So definitely, when it comes to young players,
what do you do? Like, how difficult is it? You know, we talked earlier about accountability, and that allegedly Rutherford and Boudreaux had that conversation. How do you hold the top players accountable? Right, like, we talked before his injury about Tanner Pearson's awful start to the season. Right, just a guy that's clearly lost a step. A guy that was taking ridiculous penalties 200 feet from his own net, a player that you could have sat down for a bit because he's not critical to what you're doing, right? Certainly not from an offensive standpoint. That didn't happen. Maybe it would have. But is there a player on this roster? And the challenge becomes, how do you sit veteran players, right? So there's a lot of video going around about indifferent defensive play by JT Miller, right? Like, clearly, his commitment at the start of the season and his acknowledgement and awareness of how bad it was hasn't resonated into any kind of change, right? He's still a disaster in his own end, even playing the wing. And I know he's been back at center for much of this trip. It's like, how do you sit down the player that you just extended on a 7-year, $56 million deal, $8 million a year? How do you do that? How do you sit down Tyler Myers, who has now, you know, gone back to his penalty taking woes from a year ago, even though I think he's, you know, up until now has certainly done some things better and is a player who generally you can't question their effort. But, you know, you see guys with shoulders down and I don't want to call them quitters, but there are signs of that at various stages in games where they just shut it down. How do you sit players like that? How do you take a player like Myers, who's playing 20 minutes a night, and sit him?
You know what I mean? Just do it. Like you have to, because at the end of the day, when it comes, I think Miller's a different conversation when it comes to him, because he's producing so much offensively and because he is such a volatile kind of character. Maybe it starts with a benching or even when it comes to like, whether it's Miller or I don't even want to necessarily pick on him, but at a certain point, Besser has to show something before with those forwards, Miller and Besser, I think it would start with cutting their minutes. That at least has to be a start before we even get into the whole benching thing. When it comes to the back end, I don't understand why you can't sit a Myers or whomever. Like, I'm looking at Kyle Burrows. I'm looking at the way he battles his ass off, the heart that he shows, him being inserted into lineup right away, the physicality. I just don't see anyone else on this roster, aside from the couple names that you mentioned, who plays that competitively. And when you combine that with how decent and passable he was at the early part of the season, I don't understand how you can sit a guy like that when the team is so deflated and you're talking about work ethic being an issue. So at a certain point, you just have to play the players that are playing the best, that are giving you the most, that are actually showing that they give a damn. To me, like, you just have to do it.
Here's the challenge. More than half your roster is not in that category that you just described. So you're always going to be playing players who are kind of below that threshold of acceptability. Just the way it is. So you're choosing, you know, these two to make an example of this game and maybe these two to make an example of things next game. But you've always got players in the lineup because there are so many players on this roster who completely look deflated. They look like, holy shit, we went through this a year ago and we had a coaching change and we had a bump and we played incredible hockey and we still didn't get into the playoffs. We now have no chance. Like, there have to be players right now who are looking at the situation saying, it's over. The season is over. There have to be players that are thinking that. And I don't know how you avoid that at this stage, right? And you can't get the same kind of bump that you had a year ago. So you're always going to be playing some of these players. And it's just like, I worry about the young guys they have in their lineup. I worry about a player like Kuzmenko, who's going to say, I'm a free agent after this year. Get me the hell out of this place, right? I'm worried about Elias Pettersson, who's on a short-term bridge deal. Thank you, Jim. That's going to say, I'm going to shut my mouth and play and increase my value and get the hell out of this place. There's a lot of these guys, like, at what point, and we'll get into player by player in a minute here, but at what point does Bo Horvat tell Pat Morris? Because we've been led to believe there haven't been many conversations going on of late. Yeah, I'm good. I'll wait. I'll increase my value and I'm happy to get out of here.
That would be a good scenario for the Canucks, because it would mean they'd have to be forced into this rebuild. And I think that's where, like, you're right in terms of there are so many players under that threshold and it's tough to manage. Number one, I think you kind of have to start somewhere, because I think one of the most demotivating things that anyone who's been an athlete on a team-based sport will know, when a coach holds his top players to a different standard, when they're allowed to kind of mosey around, when they're allowed to stop caring at certain points or give up or not put in as strong of an effort, or when they're not performing and they're still being fed the same opportunities, it's really demotivating, because you're on that same roster and at a certain point you're going, well, what, like, why am I busting my tail off for? Why? If it doesn't matter, if performance and work ethic is not being recognized, if we're just going off of contracts, how much a player earns, status and pedigree, then what's the point? You're going to lose other players in that room. Now, and having said that, I agree where it is a situation that like one or two scratchings aren't going to fix the overall culture of this group. And that's kind of precisely why you need to blow it up. I mean, after the Toronto game, I mean, it was really damning hearing Boudreau honestly sort of say that we stopped playing. And the quote was, we stopped playing. It happens every game that there's a 10-minute lull or 10-minute something. And it reemphasized again, we sort of stopped playing. I think that's one of the most damning things about this team is when you saw them against an opponent like Montreal. Montreal is a lot less talented. And look, they're going to lose a lot of games this year. But at least they work hard, and at least they have young pieces who are growing together. Whereas you look at this Canucks team, that's why I feel like for fans right now, it's so tough to get behind them. The situation that they're in is just you're seeing a group of players that they've been given their contracts, they've been paid, and they're just kind of going through the motions, and there's no direction. I just see a team that's unlikable and hard to really root for right now.
Well, there is that. Hard to root for, hard to cover, all of it. When we come back, we will get into a bit more of the detail around specific games in the trip, especially this weekend, certain players and how they're trending. And look, there's got to be some positive, and it was certainly, as far as the Hockey Hall of Fame is concerned, we'll get into that when we come back.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So let's start with the road trip, Harm, and let's get into the Toronto game where the Canucks come out, play a good first period, get out to a 2-0 lead. Spencer Martin played really well in that first period because the Leafs did have some chances. He did his thing. But as soon as that early goal happened in the second period, you knew where this was headed given the fragility of this team, you know, and it included two power play goals as well, which also becomes predictable.
For sure. And can I just say, by the way, Jordy Benn scoring the third goal,
the
game-winning goal, and especially early on the trip, Travis Hamonic also scoring. Everybody loves a revenge tour against the Vancouver Canucks. But yeah, I mean,
who do we have in Buffalo? Who's in Buffalo they want to have revenge with?
Well, and there's also the fact that the 3-2 scoreline was pretty flattering because, as you mentioned, Martin was unbelievable through a large stretch of that game. The number of odd man rushes, the difference in speed, it was really alarming. And I almost don't want to, my biggest takeaway from this and watching all these teams that they play against is the best case scenario for this Canucks team going into the season was to be the Nashville Predators of last season. Nashville last year relied on elite goaltending from UC Saros, some special performances at the top of their lineup, right? They had Roman Josi playing like a Norris Trophy caliber defenseman. That's what you would have maybe been hoping for out of Hughes. They had Philip Forsberg and Matt Duchene absolutely crushing things. Duchene having a 40-goal year, and that presumably could have been Pettersson or Horvat or Miller this season. They made the playoffs and they got swept by the Avs in four games. And that's just, to me, the biggest takeaway looking at this team this season is even if we had seen a best case scenario, even if this team had played to the peak of its potential against some of these teams, it just would not have been close to good enough. And part of me doesn't you know, like you brought up the road trip and we're talking about the Toronto game, and I don't want to kind of shift in a completely different direction, but I kind of have to, because it gets to this overall strategy of, if you're ownership right now, and we talk about how hard it is to be a fan of this team, how hard it is to cover this team, how is it not difficult to be an owner of this team? Like, do you not have any pride? I mean, every friend that I have right now who's not a diehard Canucks fan, they see me and they'll kind of snicker and laugh and they'll go, how about them Canucks, buddy? Great start to the season again. And I feel slightly embarrassed, and this is my career. If you're the owner of the team, you're like imagine the highs.
Dude, you're way too young for that. You're way too young for that.
No, I mean, I know I'm privileged, but still, it's just like, it kind of stings, you know? It's kind of like people mock
you
for it.
And they're laughing. You got this dream job at your age and then people are laughing at you.
Well, they're laughing at the team mostly.
They're laughing at you having to deal with it.
Exactly. And I'm just thinking, like, how does Francesco, like, how does he feel? Especially because if you were the owner of, let's say, the 2011 team, you're on cloud nine. Like, Francesco had a long stretch there where he was the man everywhere in the city that he went. Now contrast that to where he must feel now. And
he's the reason. Like, everybody now feels he's the reason.
They do. And look, we get it at this point. The motive is probably making home playoff game revenues. But there's an analogy to think of. And it's kind of like, even if you don't care about winning a Stanley Cup, let's say you only care about playoff revenue, you got to think about it kind of like writing a test. If you go into a final exam and you move with the intent of, oh, I've just got to pass the test, there's no guarantee you're actually going to pass the test, because your mindset is simply passing the test. You're going to do the bare minimum to try getting back. If instead you approach the test and you go, I need to ace this test, who knows if you'll actually ace the test, but I bet you're at least going to pass, right? And that's where, if you rebuild the right way, who knows if you'll actually become an elite team. But what I can guarantee ownership is that at least you'll make the playoffs almost every year. And that in and of itself has to click, where it's like you take shortcuts every year and it doesn't even result in the playoff revenue that you're after. Whereas if you embrace the rebuild, you'll actually get the playoff revenue that you're after. Like, that's the part that I don't understand.
I know, but it's interesting, because I believe in ownership's minds, or at least in Francesco's minds, they've tried to rebuild, right? Like, there's been moments along the way where for a few minutes, you know, they kind of think, okay, yeah, we can take a step back to take a step forward, when really you need to take a giant leap back in order to get where you need to be, right? And there were moments when Trevor was here that they thought they could do it, but then they got impatient. You know, and then there's moments here where, you know, when Rutherford first got hired, they kind of understood they were going to need, there was going to be a little bit of pain. They certainly never framed it as a rebuild of the fans. But yeah, like, there's such a lack of consumer confidence. And eventually, like, it manifested itself in Jim Benning after 8 years. And, you know, first they made the change because everyone got impatient with Mike Gillis when they were so close to tasting the cup. They didn't get it. And 3 years later, they had to make a change. Because what is happening here? When really you gutted all your assets to make runs and you didn't ultimately get it. And now you're reaping that, right? And now, you know, you look at this situation and I'm just trying to think of how they view the end game, because they believe on some levels that we did have to suck to get a player like Elias Pettersson. We did have to suck to get a player like Quinn Hughes, right? And you almost feel in their minds they've dealt with a level of pain because they haven't been in the playoffs for this long, minus the bubble year, when in reality, the reason they're in this is because they haven't taken the full step back. It's been baby steps back, right? So, you know,
well, it's not only the one point I want to make is they were pushed back into taking that step. So it was totally, like a forceful agree. Thrust where they were still trying to make the playoffs when you consider all the Eric and Branson acquisition, the Brandon Sutter acquisition, signing obviously Louis Eriksson back in the day. Like, they continued trying to make these additions. They accidentally did the losing of a rebuilding team. They actually never committed to that direction. So yes, they felt the pain, but they never actually, like ownership has to realize that they never actually committed to that direction.
Yeah, it's like Edmonton, right? Like I had this conversation with Dustin Nielsen after the CFL game last night. We were talking about it. I said, you know, people now in Edmonton believe they actually built, which is all nonsense, right? They fluked into McDavid and then kind of worked around.
Oh, yeah.
But before that, right, every year, whether it was Craig McTavish or Kevin Lowe or pick your guy, every year they were trying to make the playoffs. They were trying to do what the Canucks are doing. They were trying to add that missing piece, you know, to some of their lower picks and their higher picks. And they figured, okay, this is the year we can make a run to get back in. That was always the case because they never believed the market could handle a rebuild because the market was so used to winning, you know, from the Gretzky teams. And they weren't as far removed from that as they clearly are now. And it was always a feeling of we're trying to get in. Then they stumbled into McDavid, right? Like just all the incompetence of trying to get in got the McDavid. And then it's kind of worked, right? And the Canucks have not tried to build. They're trying to do the exact same thing. Everything get in, like every year they're trying to get in. They think that's the answer. And it's probably going to take an ownership change in order to change that, because that truly is the messaging. Ownership believes they've suffered long enough. And no matter what they say, I don't think the fan base is ever going to believe that they're going to live up to it, right? Like ownership could put out a New York Rangers style letter and say, this is what we're going to do. And nobody's going to believe that they'll actually see it through, because within two seasons, midway through year two post letter, you're going to do something that completely flies in the face of what your messaging is. So let's take us, you went through this in your article. What is the path to a tank right now, which is the first step to a rebuild?
Yeah, it's the biggest takeaway was, and this is why it emphasizes the importance of picking a decisive direction as soon as possible, is that the Canucks are right now, as currently constructed, unless you dismantle it, until they make substantial change, they're too good to realistically tank. Now, before, like a lot of people will say, with the Canucks' lottery luck, they'll never luck into Connor Bedard anyway. Well, first of all, the important thing to keep in mind is the entire sort of like top 5 to 7, the entire top of that 2023 draft class is stacked. It's not just Connor Bedard. Adam Fantilli's current production rate in the NCAA is better than Jack Eichel's draft year NCAA production. Matt Vemichkov, our colleague over at The Athletic, Scott Wheeler, described him as the best player he's ever ranked number 3 in a draft class and the best prospect out of Russia since Alex Ovechkin. So this isn't just about the Bedard sweepstakes. This is about the entire top and trying to finish bottom 5. The problem is, we've seen this story the last couple of seasons with these starts. Obviously, last season they had the massive Boudreaux bump in the second half, but also even in the 2021 season, you consider all the circumstances that went against them, everything that went wrong. Elias Pettersson missed the entire second half of the season with his wrist injury. Thatcher Demko was mediocre in the first half of the season while he and Holtby kind of flipped starts before Demko kind of started rolling and took over the mantle as the number one in the second half of the year. JT Miller was awful defensively in the first half of the 2021 campaign, pretty similar to how he's played this season with the turnovers, the inconsistent work in his own end. On top of that, they went through the worst COVID-19 outbreak of any professional team in North America, and they were forced back early, which caused them to win only 7 of their last 18 games down the stretch. Despite all of those factors against them, they still only netted the 9th overall pick. And you look at the team right now, with Thatcher Demko, for example, all it's going to take is one hot stretch for him to kind of ruin a tanking effort if the team around him stays intact. We mentioned Miller. He's not going to be this bad defensively the whole year, especially if he sticks at wing. Quinn Hughes has a lot more, like forget the point streak. He has not looked like Quinn Hughes. You look at his underlying numbers, especially defensively, he's looking like the 2021 version of Hughes. He has a lot more to give, and he will, at a certain point, bounce back. Even look at the penalty kill, which is genuinely awful. The problem is it's not going to be 61% the whole year. That's 12 percentage points worse than the Red Wings' penalty kill last season, which was dead last in the league. So even if you're the worst penalty kill through the remainder of the season, you're still going to get better results than they've gotten at this point. So that kind of underscores, especially when you look at the lackluster, like all the basement dwelling competition around them, the Canucks need to kind of be proactive in looking at the pieces around the roster and starting to shed talent. And that's why earlier when you mentioned the idea of would Bo even want to re-sign in this type of environment, it's almost good for the franchise to kind of be forced into the direction of moving him and looking at not only him, but your other pending UFAs, like whether it comes to an Andre Kuzmenko or a Luke Shen or a lot of the players on this roster, discussing Miller itself and trying to find a way to potentially shed his contract. The biggest takeaway in looking at the other teams that are expected to be Bedard sweepstakes contenders is that if you want a realistic shot at finishing bottom five, you can't take a passive approach. I'm not saying you need to move all your assets tomorrow, but you can't wait until the day before the deadline to start picking up the phone and making calls. You're going to have to pick this decisive direction now. You can't just, for example, we talked about this earlier, you can't just go out and chase a new coach bump. Like, this has to be a decision you make now. It's now or never in terms of making a decision on fully rebuilding, stripping things down.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I just think that I think it's going to take some time. Like, this is going to require an extreme amount of finesse. This is not just throw a dart at the board and make a trade. There's got to be a full big picture plan of who we want to move, how we want to move, and what we're willing to settle for, right? It's not as simple as just saying, okay, well, we'll get rid of JT and then we'll do this, or we'll get rid of Brock, you know.
I agree.
And that's it, right? Like, there's got to be a systematic approach to who do we want to ride with, right? So we'll take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get into the core of this team. And we also want to talk a bit about Hockey Hall of Fame and the games ahead when we return.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
So Harm, let's talk about the core, because for the longest time, right, the core of this team was believed to be Pettersson, Hughes, Demko, right, and then Horvat and JT Miller. Is that fair? Is that the Fab Five in this team's core?
Yeah.
And then after that, it was kind of, well, the core of this team is Pettersson, Hughes, and Demko. Is that still the core? Is there an untouchable on this team?
No. No,
there isn't, is there?
There can't be, because a lot of people will sort of look at those players and look. You look at Pettersson, Hughes, and Demko. They're excellent players. Don't get me wrong. And you obviously would prefer to kind of keep them. The question is whether you can realistically win a cup and contend in their prime or before they want out. And that's where the organization over the last couple of seasons locked themselves into a situation. When you look at the OEL Garland trade, the Miller signing, and the dire state of the prospect pool, where it's going to take a ton of pain to get back to realistically being an elite team. And if Pettersson, Hughes, and Demko aren't in a position where they're willing to be part of that, you have to consider you have to consider their futures as well. Now, I'm not saying you're going out and you're willingly, aggressively shopping them, but it just means that they're not untouchables. And let's be honest, for as good as Pedersen and Hughes are, for example, we're not talking about McDavid and Drysdale, where you're talking about, oh, you can't move those guys, even with those players on this roster. Pedersen, Hughes, and Demko, we've seen the results the last 3 years. It hasn't even been close to good enough. And for as talented as these guys are, we're not talking about generational talents.
No, we're not. No, we're talking about players who have the ability to be really good. I've certainly felt going into this year that, you know, I thought it was a possibility for Pedersen to be a top 10 scorer in this league. I mean, JT Miller was a year ago, and, you know, I think they need him to kind of be a top 10 forward, if nothing else. We thought that in his first year that was going to be his ceiling. And look, I still think he's trending in the right direction. I would love a scenario if, yes, me, the two players I would keep more than anybody else would be Pedersen and Horvat. I'm telling you right now. Just because I think they've got the combination of skill and character, right? And, you know, it's not just about Bo being a good guy. It's about what Bo is doing right now, that his ability to shed all the distractions around him in terms of how terrible the team is, along with the contract that's weighing over his head, and still completely dial in and be that guy and play consistently night in, night out at both ends of the ice, right? And I know fans don't care about the media, but for me, I equate his ability to talk post-game, every game, to the Sedins, who are the height of character and the height of culture. And we had that in this organization back then. Nobody hid from it, right? If you played poorly, nobody hid from it, right? Whether you were the Sedins, whether you were Luongo, whether you were Kevin Bieksa, whether you were Dan Hamhuis, pick your guy, nobody hid from it. Different culture in this room now. Right. And again, more than anything, it's not that side of it, but it's not just the person and how he carries himself, but it's just what he's been able to do on the ice with garbage around him. And this pressure of his future and his career over his head, I think has been remarkable. And it speaks so much to him and what he could do for other young players that get brought in. Right. And just in terms of pure talent, if you talk about the original core of Demko, Hughes, and Pedersen, you know, from a consistency standpoint, I would be taking Petey in that group if you could keep him. And again, he's not untouchable. He's not generational. You're 100% right. But if you give me my choice, those are the two players I would keep, and everybody else I would move on from.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to a couple things, obviously when it comes to the Hughes and Pedersen specifically, like, the preference is obviously to keep those guys. We're speaking more just for anyone who's listening and thinks that we're advocating that they trade everyone. It's just saying that they're not untouchables, that you at least listen and think about it, considering the bigger direction. If you commit to a full tear it down, rebuild, and you commit to tanking for the next couple of seasons. When it comes to Horvat, though, I fully agree with so many of the points that you brought up, especially the culture of accountability, which there hasn't been enough of on this team, especially when you hear someone like Stan Smeal last season talking about there not being enough of that in the organization. That matters in terms of the culture, but can the Canucks afford that type of contract when you have Ekman-Larsson on the books, when you have Miller still on the books? Like, how many veteran contracts can you kind of have?
Well, you're not wrong, and that's what I'm saying, is that you can only keep Horvat if you wind up finding a way to get out of some of these other deals. And I know that's easier said than done, because my challenge with all of this is that what will you have to give to get rid of some of those deals, to have a true rebuild? Because Ekman-Larsson's contract's on the books for too long. JT Miller's contract's on the books for too long, right? Like, you can't let those contracts run out like Jim Benning should have done a year ago, instead of bringing Ekman-Larsson in, right? So imagine the sweeteners you're going to have to give up to get rid of these players. And I don't know if it's as simple as what the Canucks did, right? Like, what did Phoenix do to the Canucks? We'll take your terrible deals that are short-term, and we'll give you one terrible deal that's a long-term, right? So if it's as simple as that, yeah, you do it, right? Like, if you can take on somebody's bad contract that's going to expire in a year or two in exchange for parting with some of these deals, okay, you find a way to do that. But if you're going to have to give up first-round draft picks to move some of these deals, they had to give up a second to move on from Jason Dickinson. If you have to move first round picks to get rid of some of these epic contracts, How do you live with that? Like, how long does that take? Do you have to give up? Are you going to have to move players like Hughes and Demko and Pettersson to rid yourself of one of these deals? Like, what's it going to take? Because you can't get rid of them and lose your draft picks and then only have cap space to create opportunity cost, right? Like, you can't do it that way. It's not that simple, is it?
You're right. I think when it comes to, well, first of all, there's also in a couple of years, the buyout route for Ekman-Larsson, which obviously isn't ideal, but if we're talking about a hypothetical rebuild, I mean, like, who cares? To be honest, like, you can deal with that. Miller, I think, for as bad as he's been defensively, and I think we might have had this conversation earlier, and I'll have to do more digging on this, especially as we get closer to the deadline, but he's still producing a lot, and there are enough. I wonder if there are enough desperate GMs to where you could flip that contract without having to give up a sweetener. Especially, like, he's still got, like, what, 9 goals in 15 games. He's right around a point per game. I wonder if there are enough short-sighted general managers who only care about the here and now, the same way Jim Benning did not care about the long-term future, about the Oliver Ekman-Larsson contract. He only cared about what OEL could provide for the team now, and especially with the cap going up. I think the Miller contract, I at least wonder if it might not be totally onerous in terms of offloading it. So that could at least be a potential silver lining.
Yeah, it's possible. It is. But like I said, I mean, those buyouts are painful, especially for a contract that's that size.
So, they are. Well, I mean, you wouldn't buy out Miller. He's got too many bonuses.
I'm talking about Ekman-Larsson, right? Yeah. Like, that's still a painful contract to buy out because it still does affect your cap. Not to the number it does now, but there's still an effect there. I mean, are you willing to bury contracts for year upon year in the minors? Like, there's certain things you probably won't do because of how that looks on your organization, right? Like, how far are you willing to go?
Well, OE also has a no move, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, he does. So that's a tough thing. And look, the other thing to keep in mind is if you're going in that direction anyway, you might just have to have one of those contracts and have it be the way Buffalo has Jeff Skinner on the books right now. And they're kind of just able to, yeah, it's an anchor, but you're able to kind of work around it. And especially as the cap goes up, if you have one poison pill contract, you can at least live with it. What you can't live with is multiple ones.
Yeah, and it looks like they've got one in Brock Besser's. I mean, and his is 3 years, so the length of the pill is a little bit different. But what are they going to, like, where do they go with Besser and his, like, do we assume it's just going to come back because it always does at various times? Or is there a real concern there? And look, I think we all wanted the best for Brock because of what he went through personally a year ago. Mm-hmm. Right. And we were all willing to just see it through with him. Right. Because it was such a tragic situation around his father. You know, now they're into this season and he had talked about a fresh start and, you know, not thinking about that on a daily basis. And, you know, he is injury prone. Like, that's just, I know Drancer denied it earlier, but he is clearly injury prone. Where do they go? Where do they go on Brock?
Yeah, and that's the issue in terms of the injury-prone sort of description is the talent and ability has never really been a question with Brock, but he's come back, and I think initially when he was hurt in preseason, we were expecting him to miss a few games, and clearly he came back early and was still playing hurt, and that's why he had to miss games again. But that's kind of the crux of the issue there is, can he be durable through full seasons and play up to his potential? Because hasn't scored a goal yet. And yeah, he has 8 points in 10 games, but 5 of those assists are secondary ones. They've mostly been kind of empty calorie. I think management's thought process in part was to kind of kick the can down the road where Besser was obviously coming off a down season last year. And so the thought process they, I'm assuming, had was he can only get better from here, especially when you looked at his sort of underlying numbers and some of the bounces that went against him. And the idea probably could have been, well, if he bounces back this season, then you can potentially dangle him in the offseason and he's going to have more trade value. Because last offseason, we saw wingers did not have trade value. And so Besser as an asset just wasn't worth much. Now, I think what you're hoping from this point is you've got no choice but to hope for a bounce back and that you can flip him at some point. Because, I mean, right now, no one's like, everybody loves this idea of trading Garland or Besser for this mythical top four right shot defenseman. Like, that's never going to happen. It's never going to happen given the state of the market for wingers, given how scarce cost controllable top four defensemen are, and given how Besser and Garland are playing right now. So the only hope you have, if you're Jim Rutherford, in terms of managing these players and trying to extract maximum value, whether they're still on the roster or whether you're looking to deal them at some point down the line, is you have to bet on a bounce back. That's all you can do at this point.
It's a crazy bet, isn't it? You know, and like we bet on that with Brock for a while. You're betting on that with Thatcher Demko right now. And before we go, I want to get into him a little bit because Frank Cervelli tweeted out that seems like a player that's playing through something. And you generally, people like Frank, and I know this on the football side, like I'm generally not going to speculate that if I'm not getting it from somewhere, right? Like somewhere close to the situation. So are we of the opinion that that's happening? Kevin Woodley, among others, has said flat out, this has got nothing to do with the surgery that he had in the summer, which was a minor procedure. Rick Dhaliwal indicated the same thing as well. So what do we believe is going on with Thatcher Demko?
It's a good question. I still have to do some digging on that. I've kind of been just working on an overall piece, talking to Woodley, among others, and trying to diagnose kind of what's been going on with his season. Obviously, he hasn't played up to his standards, and it's been a really tough stretch for him. I don't know, to be quite honest, in terms of where his body is at right now. When a like you said, someone like Cervelli isn't going to report that unless he's gotten that from someone close. Like you don't like every time someone like Elliot or Frank Cervelli throws out like an "I wonder" or an "I think" or "Ooh, could this be happening?" Like usually they know and they're just kind of
they're coaching it and they're framing it as speculation.
Exactly.
For sure. Like I've been there. I guess.
So it's clearly coming from somewhere. I just don't know if it's true or not at this point. When I watched Demko play, and I had this discussion with Woodley over the weekend, there isn't one specific thing that stands out as a technical flaw in his game right now. It's not as if there's one specific thing that you can point to and say, that's one weakness that he keeps getting repeatedly exposed on. And if you fix this, then his game will start looking like normal again. It seems like watching him play that it's more of Woodley seemed to say a reads sort of thing. And it's coming down to his anticipation. And when it comes to, for example, some of the odd man rushes, and we've spoken about how he's kind of been left out to dry on a lot of them, but also the reads and anticipation in terms of how far aggressively he's come out in his crease in certain situations. The way that I'm not a goalie expert, so I'm kind of paraphrasing what Woodley's been explaining to me, but just watching him play, it seems like he's kind of in his head a little bit in terms of overthinking reads in situations and that he's gambling wrong in certain spots. And he's just a little bit off in a lot of different areas. And he sort of referenced an example against in the Minnesota game where on the first road trip, Kaprizov was kind of entering the zone, sent a pass into slot to, I'm trying to remember. It wasn't Tyson Jost. I forget who it was, but to a Wild player. And it was a relatively easy slot shot that went in. And Woodley said in that situation, Demko sort of went down to his pad a little bit early and got caught going the wrong way. And that was a read thing, right? That's not a technical thing where he wasn't executing the right way. That's him mistiming the situation and anticipating it the wrong way. And then later in that same game, Zuccarello had a redirect goal on the power play where Demko was too late putting his pad down. And it's a moment where Demko probably goes, well, I was too early on that first goal, so now I'm too late on this next one. And that's where you get into the mental side and the confidence. And you're seeing goalie, I think, who's not playing off his instincts as much, who's overthinking things. But look, with his, regardless of if he's got, if he's playing through a little something, something, regardless of what the issue is right now, he's too talented and he works too hard not to figure things out. I'm not worried about him in the big picture. And that to me is kind of the biggest takeaway in all of this, especially when we talk about this Canucks team being so poor right now, being bottom three in points percentage. They're not going to stay this low when he inevitably figures things out. He may not figure it out this month. He may not figure it out next month. But
may not figure it out this year, because that's possibly been known to happen to even the most elite goaltenders, right? And I certainly think he's going to get his game back. I don't think we're talking about, you know, Corey Schneider, where it just kind of goes south in a real hurry, you know, for injuries and other reasons. I do think that he's going to be that guy, but I don't know that this is going to happen as quickly. Like, I don't believe the light's just going to come on here. I think there's going to be a little more pain.
For sure.
Before we
get. But he's also not going to be an 874 guy.
No,
like,
you're
even
right.
If he struggles, yeah, he might be like a 902 or something. You know what I mean?
Well, to get back to 902, he's going to have to play pretty good right now. Like, if, you know,
like I mean, 902 the rest of the way or whatever.
Yeah, that's feasible. But there's so many ifs around this team, and they needed so many things to hit. They needed bounce backs from so many players. You know, we talked about Brock Besser. We talked about Elias Pettersson, who finished last year strong. So we expected that. We talked about, you know, we expected Quinn Hughes to be able to pick up where he left off a year ago, right? Because he was a bright light. Thatcher Demko was a bright light when he was healthy. You know, you expected some of these things, and then you needed to hit on others. You never thought at this point in the season there would be so much that had gone wrong versus so much that had gone right from those key pieces. But here we are. And Harm, before we go, we've got to save the best for last and talk a little bit about the Sedins and Roberto Luongo along with Daniel Alfredson going into the Hall of Fame. A lot of fun to be had over the weekend. We saw the Stars game, Roberto playing out, actually scored a goal. Stories were told. Henrik was a little bit late showing up because he was dealing with COVID. So he was there for the inductions, but he was there just a little bit late. But just what was your takeaway as a guy that was pretty young when the Sedins were in their prime? I mean, you were just, what were you, like two? You were a fan when they first broke in.
Literally, I was. And that's why that 2011 team was the pinnacle of kind of me being a Canucks fan. And before I became a jaded reporter who obviously, I don't know what it is. It's happened to so many people before, but once you kind of enter this as a profession, it just kind of kills your fandom. But that 2011 team will always have a really special place in my heart. And for the Sedins and Luongo, it's just growing up in that era, it was insane because you just had this feeling of you expected to win every night. You expected to dominate the opposition every night. And it was like the team could be fifth, top five in the league, and we'd be poking holes at what's going wrong. Like, that was the standard of excellence in the bar that the Twins and Luongo were part of. And for me, they stand out because they weren't just Canucks legends, they were Vancouver legends in this city. Their impact and presence extended and spanned far beyond the hockey world. Any Vancouverite, you mentioned the Canucks and you asked them to sort of name, like, who's the first Canuck that comes to your mind? Or what comes to your mind when you mention the Canucks? You ask the average person on the street, it's not Elias Pettersson, it's not Bo Horvat or Quinn Hughes or whoever. It's immediately the Sedins and Luongo, Burrows, Kessler, that entire core, because it electrified the city. It transcended Canucks fans. And that's why those guys are so special. And it was funny because when they were initially hired, I actually went up to Henrik in the press box and I was like, man, I'm going to make you feel old. I was legit 10 years old when you guys went on that 2011 run and he had a good chuckle. But I'm curious to hear your perspective because you actually had a chance to cover these guys. do you have any anecdotes or stories, or I'm just kind of curious what it was like covering those guys.
Well, they were awesome. Right. And you know, you put into perspective, just, I remember when they first walked into the locker room, right? You see these guys that are fitness freaks now, right? They'll go out and run marathons and do all this stuff. And, you know, they were always the most fit players, you know, midway through their career and beyond. But when they first showed up, like, these guys had the worst bodies going. They looked awful. And you thought, how are these guys going to get this figured out, right? But you didn't really know them at the time. You know, they were funny when they did the Twins commercial, right, for the NHL. You know, and they took so much abuse, right? They took so much abuse on the ice from people trying to test their manhood. And they took so much abuse off the ice from everyone wanting to make fun of them. And they just continued to grind. And they just continued to persevere. And, you know, we saw a transition of a roster that went from a really good team that was led by the West Coast Express line, right? And some of the people that were part of that. And that was a really good team that just never got the goaltending figured out. But then we saw a transition, and it didn't have to be a teardown rebuild or anything like that. You know, they went from a team that contended for President's trophies and underperformed in the playoffs, but they were still a good hockey team that was fun to watch and could score and was one of the best teams in the league. And they turned that over, and they turned it over to Daniel and Henrik. And then they wind up building around these guys. And then they got the goaltending thing figured out. And you saw all these little pieces get added. But through it all, you know, whether they were adding Salo or Ham Hughes or Christian Ehrhoff, or, you know, like, you know, pick a guy, and they so strategically and effectively did it. You know, for all those people who want to give, you know, Brian Burke the credit because he drafted them, all the pieces around them were so important, and it was so skillfully done by Mike Gillis. But at the end of the day, we watched them grow, and we watched them turn into stars, and we watched them turn into leaders. And everyone wants one moment, right? Like, people ask me, like, what's the best interview you've ever done? And it's hard for me to say, because I, you know, in 28 years in the industry, I don't know that there's been like one best interview I've ever done, but I can tell you the best people I've ever been around, and that's Daniel and Henrik. And they were incredible. And they learned from Marcus Naslund, who learned from, you know, Trevor Linden. And some people will say he learned from Mark Messier and you know, whatever, because that wasn't a fun time to cover the team. But just watching them grow. And for me, and maybe it's because I'm a dad and I'm getting older, and seeing their careers from start to finish, you just have an appreciation for growth, and you have an appreciation for who they are as people. And that matters to me. And some people don't care. And when you're outside of Vancouver, they laugh at us here because they've never won a cup. The franchise has never won a cup. So when we glorify people like Stan Smeal and Trevor Linden and the Twins, people shake their heads and they laugh at us because we haven't won a cup. But do not tell me that 90% of the Boston Bruins in 2011 are better champions than Daniel and Henrik. Daniel and Henrik are the definitions of champions. They just don't have a ring. And being around them and watching them carry themselves and how much they invested in the community and how much they were just above it all and they were examples for our children, that stuff matters to me. And maybe that's trite. And maybe I should pay more attention to Pavel Bure, because he was never that guy here. And I never wanted to see his jersey get retired because all the other things mattered to me. And so watching them go through it, they were incredible people. And seeing what this franchise has devolved to has got to be gutting to them, right? And for a guy like Roberto, who was just a lot of fun, I saw him when he first came, and he wasn't fun. Roberto was a diva when he first arrived here, right? I remember doing stories on him where, you know, we were kind of, he was in a great run, but he talked about, like, he was really a struggle at handling the puck. He wasn't good at it. And so we did a story on that part of it, and he really, really got bent out of shape. And I remember one trade deadline, we were in St. Louis and TSN had brought in Mike Keenan, and Mike Keenan was talking about the first trade when he left Florida to come to Vancouver. And Roberto came up to me, he's like, why do you guys put him on your air and let him tell lies, right? And then you saw Roberto get to 2011, and he got to game 7 and he lost. And all the emotions of that run, you know, getting replaced in the Chicago series by Schneider and then getting the job back, and just the thing with Tim Thomas, you know, I pump his tires, all that, like, all of it. And you go through all of that and you lose. And that is the peak of your career. And the second that ended, everything changed, because there was nothing he was going to go through on a professional level that was going to be seen as hard anymore. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And from then on, he took himself less seriously, and the Twitter account came out, and we got to know him differently, and he took himself less seriously. The way he and Schneider handled the whole, you know, goalie controversy, both of them were incredible, but Roberto pre-2011 never would have handled it that way. And so to see his personality come out, and he also became a father at that time and got a different sense of priorities and all of it, just to see his growth was really, really cool as well. So it's not necessarily one moment, but it's seeing growth in both guys that for me, you know, really, really resonates. And fantastic people. Fantastic representatives of this organization, and we're lucky to have had them. And when people want to say outside the market, like I've seen champions, I covered the Super Bowl, I covered all the Stanley Cup finals, I was on the ice when the Bruins raised the cup and many other teams. Do not tell me that Sean Thornton, who's a great guy, is more of a champion than Daniel and Henrik. Stop. Stop. Right? Like, don't tell me that Colin Campbell's son is more of a champion than Daniel and Henrik. Don't tell me that. Like, that stuff pisses me off when people outside the market get into it, because those guys are champions. They just don't have rings.
Amazing.
That's my rant.
No, that was amazing. I legit do not want to say anything because that was so good.
Well, on that note, let's get out of here because, We got a lot of Canucks to talk about eventually. Like, we, you know, with all of this, we're going to come back here. What's it going to look like next week when we talk?
I mean, they'll find a way to somehow stoop even lower is my guess.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. Let's hope they turn.
Well, hey, that's good now.
Yeah,
No. We're hoping for that now. Winning's bad now. We're tanking for Bedard.
Is there a way they can lose but just have good effort? Or is it one and the same? Like, they can't, in order for them to keep losing,
They can chip some guys out. And then when the roster is stripped down enough, they can have good efforts and the young guys can sort of start developing and they can still find a way to lose. I buy it.
All right. Well, on that note, let's see what it looks like 1 week from now. We'll be back next Tuesday. In the meantime, if you're looking for other pod options, a Hall of Famer, Mary, and host of Visits with Craig Custance and Sean Gentile on the Athletic Hockey Show USA on Tuesday. Meanwhile, New Jersey Devils GM Tom Fitzgerald joins Rob Pizzo, Jesse Granger, and Mike Russo this week on the Athletic Hockey Show. And you can subscribe to the Athletics NHL YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/The Athletic Hockey Show. And as for us, please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Leave a rating and a review. And right now, you can pick up an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. We'll talk to you next Tuesday.